Hello, everybody. This is our 78th Esoteric Astrology Adventure. We have been working through the Scorpio chapter after some pause. And here we have page 213. That's where we came to. And I think it is worthwhile to look at a little of what we said before. We're talking about the way that under the sixth ray, a religion such as Christianity can be slanted in a certain direction which was not at all intended by its founder. We're speaking of St. Paul, who was a disciple at that time, moving towards the third degree, but having passed the second and intensely involved in the whole apparent conflict between the Judaism of the time and the emerging sect within Judaism called, well, I don't know if it was called Christianity at that time, but it was an emerging sect that believed in the Master Jesus, or the Initiate Jesus, and his resurrection and his promises and that which the Christ said through using the body of the Initiate Jesus. Interesting that Jesus himself had taken not only the second initiation as Joshua, but the third initiation as Joshua the high priest. And so we see that St. Paul at the time was still an initiate of the second degree, though working through the third, and probably it is to be suspected taking the fourth initiation as a representative of the new sect of Christianity. It's interesting to see when those who are our present masters, the ones we work with most closely, when they took the various initiations. Apparently, Master Moria, who may well have been Moses, took the third degree when receiving the law. Some think that was a very long time ago. Others place it more in the time of Joshua, before the wandering in the wilderness, before the fleeing from the land of Egypt. Or not before that, but following that episode of fleeing from the land of Egypt and wandering in the wilderness. So it was St. Paul, says the Tibetan here, who gave the Scorpio Mars slant to the interpretation and exposition of the Christian teaching, and deflected, that's quite a strong word, deflected this interpretation and exposition of the teaching, deflected the energy of this teaching into channels of teaching which its founder had never intended. Elsewhere, D.K. tells us that in a way he emphasized the ancient blood religion of the Jews and also tried to, we understand, reconcile it with certain Hellenistic concepts. And this is the great warning, I think, to all of us. Such is often, he says here, the undesirable effect of the activities of well-meaning disciples. And in that time, it was the Apostle Paul as the unredeemed Saul, S-A-U-L, who was in a way a well-meaning disciple. Such is often the undesirable effect and activities of the well-meaning disciples upon the work which they undertake to carry on after the originator of some work for the hierarchy passes over to the other side through death or relinquishes his task in order to take up other duties. So even on the road to Damascus, the preparation for the third initiation may have begun, but Saul was undertaking that trip to Damascus mainly to challenge those who had undertaken the new allegiance to the new sect. So it was only after he was stopped by the voice of the Christ along the way, that he began to undertake the dissemination of the Christian teaching. And even then, he was not fully influenced by the energy of love as later he came to be. So he was still extremely zealous, and he transferred the same zeal with which he persecuted the members of the early sect. He transferred that zeal to the propagation of the tenets of that sect, which he now accepted under the influence of that voice and the influence of the undeniable blinding light. So Mars can still be pretty strong at that stage of development, and we understand that a hidden planet and Mars contend with each other at the time of the third initiation, with that planet probably being Vulcan, and the spiritual will must win over the driving impetuosity and combative nature, zealous nature of Mars. The zeal, of course, must be preserved in another way. It's not that we can ever relinquish our zeal. Master Moria tells us to apply fiery striving always. And he's speaking, I suppose, to disciples of all kinds. It's just that the zeal is a burning sort of fuel to propagate the life, which is basically directed towards still higher objectives, but under the control of the soul, or the love, wisdom, energy. So then we came to the end of Esoteric Astrology Adventure EAA 77. I divided it into two parts. It's basically a two-hour program, A and B. And we're beginning with EAA 78, section A of that. Each section of that type is about an hour long. I'm in a position here where the internet is slow, and the conversion into a form of program that all can use, rather than just some, takes an inordinately long time. So sometimes I simply go ahead with a program of a number of hours to save the conversion time. And then I rely upon Brett, who is assisting me in all of this, to divide it into programs of smaller duration, shorter duration. So the blood theme and the death theme, these are very scorpionic. The suffering and the dire testing of the disciple, the value of the individual conflict, and the consciousness of the misery of existence are basically due to the combined influences of Scorpio and of Mars, which have ruled Christianity for so long, and which are only now beginning somewhat to lose their influence, and that was 80 years ago. We're reminded that on the fixed cross, we experience blinding light, Taurus, fiery pain, Leo, bitter woe, Scorpio. And that fits in with this blood theme and death theme. All of the pain of the required detachments. This is what we do experience. And the individual struggles on. I suppose in some way that's an improvement over the resignation to endless reincarnational opportunity as offered in Hinduism and in some forms of Buddhism. The adherents of those ways of life sometimes do not strive forward as an individual, as one must, and rely upon the slow processes, the inevitable reincarnational processes, to bring them opportunity without a great deal of internal struggle and effort, which struggle and effort basically accelerate the process at a certain stage upon the path. I think so many people are now tired of the of this particular aspect of the Christian theme and are looking for its transition into a more universal religion of love, which really serves the message of the Christ and not so much the message of St. Paul, although St. Paul, at this time, as the Master Hilarion, would no longer agree, of course, because of his expanded perception as a master, with the position that he propagated at that time. But thus it is with the masters. They are intense at a certain stage of evolution. They make a deep impression upon others, and then later they become still more enlightened and have to deal with the karma of that which they set in motion. They set in motion a certain energy streams which become part of the conditioning of humanity, and then these are karmic factors in a larger sense, not so much the personal karma of things done wrong in an individual way, but they are undertaking the rectification of some of the karma of humanity for which they have been responsible. And we do find the Master Hilarion working closely with the Master Jesus at this time, and some of his work is in the field of religion as he tries to undo much of the blind faith which he seemed to instill in people's consciousnesses and help them understand that religion is an aspect of science as well. The union of science and religion can be achieved. This he tries to do at this time. He has multiple activities. Thus it is with so many of the masters, their areas of interest are not all known to us, but they are not simply one-pointedly interested in only one thing. They have many abilities and multiple interests, so that it's difficult to pigeonhole them and say they work only at this. A study of the processes of death, as the sign Scorpio conditions them, because there are other types of death, conditioned by other signs, and the processes of death as we see them working out in the sign Pisces, would be of very real value. We see that in each case, Pluto is involved. Pluto as a somewhat higher ruler in Pisces. So, Pluto involved. The esoteric and hierarchical ruler of Pisces, but a kind of special ruler in Scorpio. DK doesn't really call it orthodox or esoteric, but Pluto is a sub-ruler. The sub-ruler of its own alter ego, Mars. So, in a way, Mars is to Pluto as Venus is to the Earth. Death through the influences of Pluto and death through the influences of Mars are widely different, and DK is going to perhaps explain this. There are subtler deaths involved, and the enhancement of the penetration of consciousness is promoted very much by Pluto. Mars leads through battle to revelation, but Pluto has this somewhat deeper effect and eliminates many obscurations to consciousness. Pluto, or the planet of death, as DK tells us, never destroys consciousness. When we see Pluto in aspect to Venus, it can mean many things, but the clarification of consciousness through the relinquishment of obscurations to soul perception is one of the things that can be meant. That's the thing about astrological aspects and positions in sign and houses. They mean so many things. It requires the intuition of the astrologer to determine what may be the meaning in the particular context, which is the individual or group being considered. So anyway, Mars and Pluto, widely different. Pluto is an esoteric planet, although it is less developed than Mars, which in a sense is its teacher. So there are some enigmas surrounding Pluto. It's an esoteric planet, but not yet a sacred planet, nor is its alter ego, Mars, a sacred planet. In the case of Venus and Earth, of course, Venus is a sacred planet, and it is the alter ego to Earth, which is not yet a sacred planet, at least outwardly. Death in Pisces through the energy of Pluto is transformation. A transformation so vital and so basic. Okay, death in Pisces through the energy of Pluto is a transformation, and thereby, in a way, an enhancement of consciousness. And then DK is going to quote here some of the old commentary. A transformation so basic that the, and then quote, ancient one is no longer seen. He sinks to the depth of the ocean of life. He descends into hell, but the gates of hell hold him not. He, the new and living one, and I assume then the transformed one, leaves below that which has held him down throughout the ages, that which has obscured his consciousness, and rises from the depths unto the heights, close to the throne of God. Interesting that we can consider here Aries, Pluto, Shambhala, and that rising is a kind of resurrection connected with Aries, and Shambhala is the throne of God. So this scorpionic experience leads to a resurrection in which Pluto plays a big part. It may be a non-sacred planet, but all planets are gods when compared to what the tiny human god is. They are great gods, and they each can have a very powerful effect upon the human soul and human monad. So the Ancient One, in many respects, is the personality, and Pluto brings death to those states of consciousness which are strictly personal and material and under the spell of the lower elementals. In this case, Pluto kills the moon. Just the way the moon falls in the sign Scorpio, which is ruled by Pluto. So the Buddhic consciousness eventually obscures all the illusions which have hitherto obscured soul and higher consciousness. He sinks to the depth of the ocean of life, so he goes all the way down to the lowest plane. We're not just speaking of water. We're speaking of matter as water. He descends into hell, which is the lower worlds, not just the hell of the lowest astral plane, but the hell that exists in this frozen external material world. But the gates of hell through which he has passed, by coming into incarnation, hold him not. He returns. Those gates of hell now become the gates of entry into the mysteries. And he is transformed. He has shed his old skin. He has shed the lower vestures and their domination over him, and has now a new life. It's almost the way the poison of the serpent can become an elixir of life. Pluto is related to that process, and so is Scorpio. So he's now the new and living one, and he leaves below all those phases of consciousness which have obscured his higher potentials for consciousness, and rises from the lower three worlds, which are the dense physical vehicle of the solar logos and planetary logos, unto the heights. He rises through the cosmic ethers, close to the throne of God. We don't know how close, but when we undergo the ascension initiation, we sit at the right hand of God. And this may be on the monadic plane, or in the case of Christ, a seventh degree initiate on the logoic plane. So this is not simply the slaughter of the form. When we're dealing with slaughter, it is so Martian, and slaughterhouses where in the animal form is brutally separated from the animal consciousness, are ruled far more by Mars than by Pluto. The blood is flowing there, the red blood, and it's a symbol of the sacrifice of the animal nature. It also is coming to an end. DK talks about the cruel meat-eating groups of the last 500 years. They are barbaric in that sense, and there are many among us today. Although Alice Bailey said it's better to eat beefsteak with a pure heart than to be a gossiping vegetarian. So the slaughter upon the battlefield of life, the slaughter in the slaughterhouses, is a Martian process, rather than a transformational Plutonian process. The veils are shed. The veils are penetrated by Pluto. This is not so much the case with Mars, but the battles, the pre-revelatory battles of Mars, do wear away the veils so that revelation can come, the types of revelation we spoke of earlier. So anyway, the personality and its consciousness are obscured. Christ, we know, are told, he harrowed hell. The story goes that after his crucifixion, of course it was technically the Master Jesus who was crucified, the Christ went into the hell worlds, I suppose, of the astral plane, and brought forth those who could respond to his message. But the Tibetan has assured us that our own lower world that we habitually live in is a far greater hell, hell in its truest sense. So the very coming of Christ, working through the Master Jesus, was a harrowing of our physical plane life, the hellishness of it, and the drawing forth magnetically and through the power of love of those who could follow him into higher worlds. So anyway, the old commentary that we've just discussed, the connection of these words with Christ, the present world Savior, as there are many, many to come as well, is obvious in their implications. Christ ascended to the throne of God, and he, as the Savior, he drew many after him in that direction. So, and yet these words were written in our archives, the Master's archives, over 7,000 years ago. So DK is writing at the end of the age of Pisces, pretty much. And we might consider that 7,000 years would bring him into the age of Aries, into the age of Taurus, and either at the beginning of the age of Taurus or the end of the age of Gemini. It would seem, if we look at ages as approximately 2160 years, or actually still more approximately 2500 years ago, we may be beginning the age of Taurus or ending the age of Gemini. These are the shorter precessional ages, not the long ones of some 25,000 years. It would seem that during the age of Gemini, much of importance to the hierarchy would be written, as Mercury and Gemini are both signs of written communication and placed in the archives. And we don't know what culture, in which culture this may have occurred. It's worth pondering. I think that what we find in the ancient archives has come from many different ages. DK talks about writings that are Atlantean in their origin, that are older than Sanskrit, even older than the language Sensar. Probably in this archive are contents that were may have even been contributed during the Lemurian root race. So one day these things will be made clear to us. Right now our task is to utilize what is presented to us in the best possible manner to achieve our own freedom and the freedom of all those we can influence. Death in Scorpio is of a different nature and is also described in the same ancient writing in the following words. So we've just been dealing with death in Pisces. It involves the later initiations in a way, release from the human kingdom altogether. It is the death through which a world savior passes. It reminds us of the idea that the final incarnation for some few, acting very much under the will aspect, is taken in Pisces. And there's a lot of finality and a climax in what we have read above here, as Pisces seems to give way to Aries, where the Ancient One sits upon his throne on the very highest plane, the Logoic plane. Now he talks about the death in Scorpio. The Ancient One dies by drowning. I suppose he is surrounded. Well, let me read it first, and then we'll analyze it. Excuse me. The Ancient One dies by drowning. Such is the test. There is that word. The waters envelop him, and there is no escape. He drowns. The fires of passion are then quenched. The life of desire ceases its appeal, and to the bottom of the lake he now descends. It's not an ocean anymore, is it? Later he reascends to earth, where the white horse waits his coming. And this he mounts, proceeding towards the second death, that is, towards Pisces. So there is the death of the personality here, or at least the death of the emotional vehicle and its desire body, and a preparation for the more ultimate death, which leads to the release from the fourth kingdom of nature already. We're not there yet when we're talking about Scorpio, which is ruling the first three initiations, and the second one particularly. So the Ancient One is submerged in the waters of the astral plane, and all of the ancient emotional impulses surround him. He's completely engulfed. He drowns. But the fires of passion for lesser things are quenched, and he is purified of his desire for that which holds him to the earth. Mars and the fire of passion in Aries is a different type of burning. And even Mars, as it operates for the average individual in the sign Scorpio, where desire can become incredibly insistent, is also different from the state that is here described. So the usual passions are quenched by this experience, this emotional experience, this submergence in all of the promptings of the astral plane, which are seen then as wanting. And he realizes that these very desires have been holding him to the lowest worlds. So they are seen as no longer appealing. He dies to them. This is what it means to have the death of the desire nature at the second initiation. I think it's pretty much the second initiation that we're dealing with specifically, but we can apply it across the board, really, to all three initiations. The life of ordinary desire ceases its appeal, and to the bottom of the lake, I suppose, the astral body, he now descends, finding all kinds of things there which have to be dealt with, which have to be raised up and expiated, transformed. The Scorpio individual discovers the depths of evil within his own nature, and no stone is left unturned when passing through this, well, let's call it in general, a psychoanalytic process. The contents of the psyche are seen, analyzed, lifted up, and expiated. So he goes through dealing with his emotional life and tends to reorient his desire nature, because he no longer wants what is presented to him. His sense of values has been altered. He realizes that he's drowning, that he's in hell, that there is a higher and better life. Later he reascends to Earth. Interestingly, Sagittarius, the sign of the white horse, is ruled esoterically by the Earth. So after passing through this psychological, internal, subtle body crisis, he can again become effective upon the physical plane, and no longer preoccupied with all that emotional drowning implies. It's a huge test to be surrounded by the errant desires of the ages, which have been concealed during the ages, so that one doesn't even know that this aspect of the Hydra really is lurking. When revealed, one has a tremendous battle. And that's why the second initiation is so very difficult to pass. The astral body is so very strong and unified. The only one of the human being's lower bodies that it actually is unified. There's a split upon the physical plane, physical etheric. There's a split upon the mental plane, lower mind, higher mind. So the white horse is awaiting his coming, especially following the second initiation, and this he mounts, proceeding towards the second death. And I'm reminded here of what is said about the relation of Sagittarius to Pisces. Let's see. Sagittarius, and it says here, Sagittarius the disciple becomes the savior in Pisces. So there's an orientation in these two Jupiterian signs. The orientation of Sagittarius towards Pisces, just as it says here in the old commentary. Of course, as I said before, Scorpio is involved in all the three first initiations, and Sagittarius, especially in the first two. But I think we're talking about a period here in which the purified individual, having relinquished, having died to the normal life of desire, becomes intensely aspiring. And Sagittarius is one of the major signs of aspiration, interestingly, along with Taurus. And here he rides in a balanced manner towards the possibilities of the third great initiation. We're told that the third initiation is not approached necessarily from the heights of aspiration, but from the level table land, and across this level table land, the mounted disciple, mounted upon the white horse of the purified personality, rides with speed. So he moves rapidly towards the third initiation, and If we're speaking of the period that follows the third initiation, Sagittarius can be very orienting towards the fourth degree, which can be taken in relation to the sign Pisces, as well as other signs. Gemini is interestingly involved there. A number of the signs can be found, Capricorn, Taurus, so forth, connected with this fourth initiation. So there are many implications here, but we undergo a tremendous subtle body purification. Camelmanus is purified, not only the astral nature, but the way the mind is involved with the astral nature. A reorientation occurs, lower desires are relinquished, the lower fires of ordinary passion die out, aspiration takes its place, and a speedy one-pointed progress of the one-pointed disciple towards higher destinations takes the place of the struggles within the depths that are common to Scorpio. So we've been given the ancient commentary here, and we see in a way that the kind of death indicated by the first of the commentaries is a higher death, and really deals with ultimate release from the human kingdom altogether and release into the kingdom of God as a full member, and finally a release into Shambhala itself, with which Pisces is associated, just as is Aries. The kind of death we're dealing with here, the death by drowning in the ordinary passions, is of a lower nature, but still gives us the initiatory orientation and orients us towards the third degree and beyond. So much is compressed within the old commentary. We see a number of different possible applications, and we try to bring them forward for our consideration. All of us at this time are supposed to be the one-pointed disciple, whether or not we are experiencing an incarnation in Sagittarius. Perhaps we already have, perhaps it's coming. We don't yet know the astrological configurations of our immediate previous lives and our immediate succeeding lives, but no doubt an examination of these configurations and an anticipation of what they will be, as the solar angel knows them to be impending, would be most interesting. So the reference here, says the Tibetan, is here to Sagittarius is clear, of course, the white horse. Just like the black bull and the white bull. If we're going to ride the bull to the swimming bull, to the island of the one-eyed men, and become the true third-degree initiate, it has to be the white bull, doesn't it? The disciple, after the death of the personality and after the killing out of desires, since the personality is so very much centered in the solar plexus and involves Camelmanus, sometimes the second degree is called the death of the personality. Though it seems to me there is a type of personality death which relates to the third degree, at which degree the personality loses its ancient authority over the consciousness of the disciple. And an actual physical plane death may be involved at the fourth degree, where the dweller, the personality, is completely sacrificed on behalf of humanity and its needs. So when we're dealing with the moon in Scorpio, dealing with the second degree, I sometimes wonder whether the entire personality is killed out or whether we have to wait a bit longer for that to happen. But certainly the desires, the lower desires, are relinquished and higher desires take their place. There are still tests personality tests which lie ahead, in which I think demonstrate that the personality is alive and well, but at least its very lowest orientations are relinquished, and very rapid progress can be made after the second degree, we are told. The disciple enters the stream and is purified in that stream and is swept along by the current of that stream. So the disciple, after the death of the personality and after the killing out of desire, each related to the other, goes on towards Pisces, where again he dies unto an eternal resurrection, a resurrection into the true life of the realization of eternity, which is soul perception and triadal perception. And he is no longer condemned to the limitations of personality consciousness, which obscure the eternal nature of life and make us believe in our own death because the personality is dying. In Scorpio, there is the death of the personality with its longings, desires, ambition, and pride. So some emotional factors are included here, but also mental factors, and factors arising from the mixing, the kamamanasic mixing of mind and desire, ambition and pride. Although ambition, or the love of power, is relegated to the emotional heads of the Hydra, and pride to the mental heads. So the different aspects of the personality, we have to die to them if there is to be the death of the personality altogether, and I would say it's far more complete at the third degree than it is at the second, though maybe the greatest of the battles occurs at the second degree because the astral body is generically so strong. In Scorpio, there is the death of the personality with its longings, desires, ambition, and pride. We learn a true humility. Hercules does kneel, does he not? And Capricorn is connected with the kneeling process as well. The great pilgrimage undertaken upon one's knees without being able to locomote, definitely limiting one's speed in a deliberate manner, handicapping oneself in a way, or, you know, the handicap seems to refer to the arms and the hands, but cutting off at the knees is also a kind of handicap, isn't it? In Scorpio, there is the death of the personality with its longings, desires, ambition, and pride. In Pisces, there is the death of all attachments and the liberation of the soul for service upon a universal scale. And that cannot be this scale cannot be achieved until the fourth and even better the fifth degree. The fourth degree is often taken in Aquarius, can be taken in Pisces too. Aquarius is the sign of universality, universal love. So we're not just speaking of service to our immediate environment and those who are near us, but we're speaking as well of service on a grander scale to humanity and to the planet, and eventually even beyond to the solar system. Two types of death. I think that's one is, in a way, the death of the personality in Scorpio, but the ancient one, interestingly enough, can also be considered the consciousness within the causal body, ancient indeed, having been our place of retreat for millions upon millions of years, and that ancient one eventually dies. Consciousness limited by the causal body dies and is released into the realms of universality, which for our purposes, as humanity can appreciate universality, those realms are the cosmic ethers. He goes on to say that Christ in Pisces exemplified the substitution of love for attachment. And of course, the Buddha also relinquished attachment and substituted for it a great and profound wisdom, not devoid of love at all, but the greater emphasis for the Christ was upon the love energy per se, the love side of the love wisdom energy. So Christ in Pisces exemplified the substitution of love for attachment. And it's such an interesting thing that the release of the radiation of true love does overcome attachment. So often we, the personality, in our personality identification, attempt to pry ourselves loose from our attachments, but we are then working strictly on the personality level with far less opportunity for success, likelihood of success. When we change our identification to a soul identification and can actually be love, then our attachments fall more naturally away. So, the substitution of love for attachment, I think we have to pass through the sixth ray phase as it is transformed into the second ray phase in order to understand this substitution. Christianity, here under the sixth ray, as he's discussing, exemplifies the death of the personality with individual and not universal implications. So we first have to learn to abide the death of that which with which we have identified for so many millions of years before we can be released into a more universal state of consciousness and effectiveness. And this is quite a statement here. You know, it is said to the sixth ray type in the sixth ray integration formula, love more your fellow men, run not so straight. You know, the path you are on leads to the outer circle of the will of God. The line goes forward to the outer rim. Stand at the center, look on every side, die not for outer forms. Forget not God who dwells behind the vision. Love more your fellow men. So one may love the ideal without loving one's fellow human beings. And here is what the Tibetan says. Love has been conspicuously lacking. And the controlling color of Christianity has indeed been red. Martian red. Not something that we're used to thinking about, perhaps at Easter time or Christmas time when the love energy is flooding the consciousness of the worshippers. But if we look at this with historical accuracy, then I think we will have to agree with the Tibetan, and there is a karmic price to pay. Some of it has been paid. There is a karmic price to pay for wielding this devoted idealistic energy in a cruel manner under the red of Mars. It is not Christ's expression, but the Scorpio Mars presentation of St. Paul. And DK really draws a line here, doesn't he? Later, St. Paul came into a tremendous realization of Buddhic love, and even now, he is working with the Buddhic energy, we are told, with the revelation of that energy. Interesting for a fifth-ray Chohan. You know, our limited conceptions of the rays and their interactions cannot fully reveal to us what a master on any of these rays may do. But it's been my theory that Paul, or Saul, was a sixth ray soul who made his transition into a second ray soul and then received this revelation of love. Is it in the 13th chapter of Corinthians, which stands out among all discussions of love as the most profound revelation of the nature of love. But the damage had been done in a way, and his zeal is what impressed Christianity to a great measure, and his later expression of the great value of love has been somewhat de-emphasized, except by those who really can understand the nature of the transition through which he passed. So it is not Christ's expression, but the Scorpio Mars presentation of St. Paul. Mars has ruled Christianity because St. Paul misinterpreted the esoteric significances of the New Testament message. And he misinterpreted because the truth, like all truths as they reach humanity, had to pass through the filter of his personality, mind, and brain, which was highly conditioned by Judaism and by Jewish theology, and therefore by a method of thinking which was prevalent in the previous solar system, and which was conditioned by the third aspect. So in many ways, St. Paul complicated the message of the founder of Christianity. Misinterpretation, this means the lower mind, well, let's just say St. Paul was subject to illusion. He had not yet taken the third degree. And illusion is to a great extent expelled or dispelled at the third degree, though ultimately not until the ninth in terms of the cosmic physical plane, we are told. But as far as the usual illusions in which humanity labors, it is dispelled at the third degree, and he had not yet taken that degree when the damage was being done, the skewing, the misdirecting, the misinterpreting. Probably every master has something along this line to live down when he is not yet illumined in the third degree sense, and with zeal presents a certain way of life or a certain teaching. So the truth of the Christ was filtered through the personality, mind, and brain, which was conditioned strongly by the ancient Jewish approach. It was then unavoidably given a personal slant and twist, because after all, St. Paul was passing through great struggles as a scorpion type. You know, he gave us that struggling ray for statement, essentially this, that the good I would do, I do not, and the evil that I would not do, that I do. So, wretched man that I am, who will save me from the body of this death? And this, the emphasis then given to Christianity is one of the struggling disciple. I'm sure it's had its value, but the simple message of love one another was not as strongly emphasized as it might be. So then the truth of the Christ was unavoidably, he said, because after all, we must pass through this area of limitation, and we become enthusiastic about a particular way of life, a particular teaching, and we want to present it. And we do present it. But what damage do we do in the presentation due to our own illusions, our still undispelled glamours, our undissipated glamours, our limitations of consciousness? So it was then unavoidably given a personal slant and twist, and this is responsible for the sorry historical story of Christianity and the dire plight of the nations today. Well, he's laying a lot at St. Paul's door, isn't he? And I imagine that the Master Jesus, as a warrior, as Joshua, as a conqueror of the land, the promised land, which perhaps was not promised at all, the promised land being more Shambhala than a piece of territory. Perhaps the Master Jesus, as Joshua, skewed certain world events in a direction that they need not have taken. So I think all of us have to be very, very cautious when we are affected by great enthusiasm and zeal under the sixth ray, because so often it is our virtues that are concealing vices, and if there is overemphasis upon a particular virtue, it becomes through imbalance a vice. I personally take this as quite a warning, and I'm sure there are many among us who can apply this to our own discipleship service. So, this skewing of the truth, this filtering of the truth, this slanting and twisting of the truth is responsible for the sorry historical story of Christianity, and even the dire plight of the nations today, which I suppose are involved, or were involved at that time, and still are to a degree, in the wars arising from conflicts of idealism. They are not dealing with each other in love and consideration. They are dealing with each other through the attempt to impose their idealism upon the others which do not share that idealism. It's a very limited point of view, but very self-justifying. It feels right, because there is a great surety concerning the idealism of any particular individual or nation. He's blinded from doubt, and doubt can be so healthy, it causes self-examination. There is no doubt in the inadequately psychologized attitude of the sixth ray fanatic. When doubt enters, a new state can supervene. And so we have many ostensibly Christian nations, suppose we're looking at Europe particularly here, yet swept by hate, ruled by fear. These are Martian qualities, reminding me of the satellites of Mars, Deimos and Phobos. I suppose fear and hatred, and at the same time swept by idealism. Excuse me. So Christian nations involved in the Great War from 1914 to 1945, this being written in the 30s, Christian nations like Germany, France, England, swept by hate, ruled by fear, and at the same time by idealism, governed by a fanatical adherence to their national destiny as they interpret it, which is really lower egoism on a national scale, isn't it? And out for blood, as the piling up of armaments discloses. So, not seeing the value of the other nation's orientation, but determined in a Martian manner to conquer, blinded by the narrowness of the sixth ray, and this is playing out on the world stage even today between what have been called clashing civilizations and the various nations which come under those categories. This involves as well religion and nationalism today, and has to be solved at last during the next 100 years, and hopefully much sooner. The sixth ray will be fading out, we are told, altogether by the early well, let's see, 22nd century, I suppose, 21-something. 21:25, 21:30. And the Pisces energy will have completely lifted and faded at the end of this, our present century. So this attitude, which is so dangerous in a nuclear age, this kind of intersection of sixth-ray Piscean fanaticism with the early development of atomic energy under Aquarius, presents some very dire possibilities to humanity. And we have to hope that somehow our better angels, as it were, can see us through this with the help of the hierarchy. We cannot have the Martian religious war about which DK warned, not specifying who the combatants would be, but now it is pretty clear who the combatants would be. And this, some 60 years after he wrote about these dire possibilities. So, blood, Mars, the spilling of blood, the attitude of conquest dictated by a narrow idealism which does not honor or see value in the other person or nation's point of view. These are sixth-ray characteristics. Well, this is the end. Yes. This is the end of the first part of 78. So this is EAA 78. And it's the A part of it. And it's page something. Let's see. Whoop. Okay. Page 215, I suppose. I'm dividing it this way, as it probably makes it a little easier to put it on YouTube. But let us continue into part B. Part B. Just continuing where we left off. The nation's out for blood, just the way competitive human beings seeking to dominate each other are out for blood. It may be done in the economic sphere, in the political sphere, in the religious sphere. It doesn't make any difference. We seek to kill the enemy rather than absorb the value of the enemy and have those other values influence our values for the good. Alexander the Great, for all of his tendency towards conquest, was strongly motivated by the fourth ray, I believe, and seemed to absorb the best values of the civilizations and groups that he conquered, especially Persia in this case. But that's not the sixth ray attitude. The sixth ray attitude is to completely annihilate the conquered group, or to enslave them. And it's amazing the calls for slavery that are still emerging in our modern era. Even sex slavery, this coming in under Mars, which we have just been seeing, rules sex. So there's a strong scorpionic tendency here, Scorpio in the lower aspect, to reawaken the Hydra and allow the Hydra to dominate. But all of this will be swept aside in the general cleansing that Aquarius will bring with the two rivers, the Alpheus and Peneus, sweeping through the stables of King Augeas, or Augeas, cleansing all the three levels. This is inevitable, but many who call for the reawakening of very ancient attitudes don't see forward. They see only backward. This is a great danger. And the sixth ray has a sentimental reactionary side to it, which seeks to seek former glory. Whenever former glory is sought, we are in a position which will lead to destruction and despair. The Italians in World War I sought the former glory of Rome. The Germans sought the former glory of the magnificent Teuton, who had been somehow corrupted. The Jewish group seeks to re-establish the ancient land of Israel. The Islamic group, some of them, seek to re-establish the conquered caliphate. Former glory is always a dangerous pursuit and is no true vision of the descending plan which the intuition reveals. So all of these negative characteristics, says DK, these are sixth-ray characteristics emphasized by Scorpio and conditioned by Mars. Scorpio is the greater entity here, the lord of the constellation Scorpio, and the lesser lord of the planet Mars, which is kind of a student, you might say, of the lord of the constellation Scorpio. So all these are sixth-ray characteristics emphasized by Scorpio. The application conditioned by the militancy, the warlike nature of Mars, whichever rules the path of the individual disciple. Interesting. Mars ruling the path of the individual disciple. It seems discipleship is necessarily, as we understand it, at least on Earth, filled with conflict. We do live on a conflicted planet, and we are graduates of a school of purifying pain and releasing sorrow. We live on a planet of painful endeavor, and so much of the pain is caused by the clash of battle, the conflict brought on by Mars, a major contributing planet to the psychic and energetic condition of the Earth at this time and of humanity at this time. So it seems that one cannot really be a disciple unless one is ready to battle on behalf of the higher aspect of oneself with the reassertion, strenuous reassertion, of the lower aspect of oneself. And today the world disciple, humanity as a whole, stands at the very portal of the path and is engaged. Well, this was written in the interim between two great wars, which DK sees as one great war, 1914 to 1945. So even though this was written in the early 30s, I suppose the masters knew in a way that they were involved in a larger war, a larger process, and could see ahead to the possibility, although they strove strenuously through goodwill initiatives to avoid the second phase of the precipitation of the war. So even then, humanity was the world disciple, today involved in all manner of conflicts and the attempt to reconcile conflicts under the United Nations. Humanity still stands at the very portal of the path, with the Aquarian energy getting stronger and stronger all the time, and bringing the universal love of the Christ closer. But as that love descends, of course, it evokes its opposite. The entire West is at this time under Martian influence, but this will end during the next 5 years. Well, okay, it's difficult to know exactly when sections of this book were written, but we do seem to be relatively in an early part of the book, which seems to have been written relatively in the mid-30s. And so this influence apparently did not really end, unless he's speaking of the influence as it manifests on the inner planes and then gradually has to work out and through the outer planes. Let's see what further may be said here, because certainly, you know, great aspects of the war were in expression during the early 40s, and even up to the winter of 1942 in the North. It was not known which way humanity would go or whether humanity would go down to defeat. So certainly the Martian influence was very, very strong. Later, I think he talks about the power of Mars waning, but that is towards the end of the war. So one wonders whether it was artificially somehow prolonged. Maybe DK was really hoping. So let's say this was written in the middle 30s, 34, 35, 36. Going forward by a few years, it could have taken us to the end of the 30s, beginning of the 40s. Maybe he was hoping that the next phase of the war would not precipitate. It certainly was a possibility that it need not have precipitated, but enough men and women of goodwill, we are told, could not be found to stem the tide of the warlike forces. So we've had Mars governing the physical body and personality. We've had Mars governing sex and the blood. let's see here. Yes. sex and the blood. And now he comes to the third factor, which Mars governs. Thirdly, Mars governs the senses, which are five in number. He seems, in a way, to be moving up through the planes. There'll be some connection of Mars with the lower concrete mind, whose number is five as well. So Mars is actually the acuity of the way we interact with our environment, the senses, five in number. Number five, I think, does relate to a higher aspect of Mars. I've suspected that one of the monadic rays of Mars is the fifth. This would correlate pretty well with Saul, Paul, as under the Martian influence, because if he had a sixth ray soul, for a while at least, giving way to the second ray, his particular influence at the moment is very much under the fifth ray, being the fifth ray Chohan. Mars is, interestingly, a rather orange planet, not just a red planet, but red-orange, correlating with the fifth ray, orange being the color of the fifth ray. Interestingly enough, some of the color presented by Venus seems to be orange as well, indicating exteriorly perhaps the fifth ray nature of that planet. So Mars is involved with the concrete mind. These senses are the basis of all human knowledge, presumably the knowledge of the concrete mind, where that which is tangible and objective is concerned or inferred. So Mars is not a subtle planet. It deals with objectivity and tangibility and is very much involved in promoting the materialistic perspective. But of course, Martian science must give way to a more subtle science, ruled perhaps by, let us call it, the occult mind of Uranus, and the higher aspects of Mercury and Neptune's sensitivity and so forth. So the five senses, and it's kind of interesting, you know, people with a strong Mars sometimes have a quite prominent lower brow from the physiognomic perspective. And that may indicate their engagement with that which the senses reveals, their engagement with objectivity. And it's not so much the higher forehead which is involved. That's more under the realm of Jupiter. The study of physiognomy in relation to the planets, I think, is very important, and in relation to the zodiacal signs. It's complex. There's much fusing and blending going on, but perhaps the eye can become discerning enough to detect these planetary and zodiacal influences on that form, which is the body and especially the face, as the more acute revealer of identity. Mars, therefore, rules science. Okay. And I do believe, in the Gokulan research, that it was not only Saturn that was found prominent in the charts of scientists, but Mars as well. Mars is this power to engage with the environment, to investigate, to learn about it. And of course, Pluto helps this tendency to engage and discover, to go even deeper. So Mars and Pluto are probing. I think they make very good planets of surgery when together. So Mars rules science. Very interesting, because you might not think this to be the case. You think, okay, here's Venus, the planet of the fifth ray. Why doesn't Venus rule science? But from a practical perspective, when we look at how people actually behave under the influence of these planets, we see that Venus is much more involved with the arts than with science, per se. The statistical work has to be done. I think it is being done by some. Gokulin started his work. But there's much, much more that can be done. And then astrology will prove itself statistically, mathematically. And the skepticism surrounding it and the imputation of mindless mysticism surrounding it will be lifted, dissipate. So Mars, therefore, rules science, and hence the reason in this present era, however long that is, for the fundamental but not permanent materiality of science. So, you know, science has been quite material for hundreds of years. Alchemy was given up, astrology was given up, no longer considered worthy of the universities. And for all through the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, 1900s, scientific pursuits have been largely of a material nature, and necessarily so, I suppose, to give us a foundational understanding of the densest physical levels. Interesting. Mars and the materiality of science. Materiality which is rapidly lessening as Mars nears the end of its present cycle of influence. Okay, I just have to find where that went. The end of its present cycle of influence. Later there's some discussion about the waning of its power, at least on the astral plane. Today, I won't say that scientists are equally divided between material and subtle approaches, but if we think of the last 100 years, science has been taken into a realm, both in medicine and in physics, which is decidedly non-material. It is material in a more fundamental sense. The very constituents of matter are being understood, but these constituents are seen to be energy constituents and not illusorily solid, as it were. Matter has become appreciated as energy. So this is a tremendous revelation, proven in a way through the atomic bomb, but certainly presented to us in the speculation of Einstein and later the quantum physicists. So a new approach to science is on its way. And I would say, in a way, it's very Uranian, although at one point DK also associates Uranus with more orthodox science, but certainly the higher potentials of Uranus to investigate the subtle, the waves, the invisible, as real, is prominent. So material science is giving way to the study of the etheric vehicle. Mars doesn't have much to do with the etheric vehicle at all. Other planets, Mercury, Uranus, ruling Aquarius and Gemini, are far more etheric in their associations. Already the trend of modern science, and this is written in the 30s, is shifting into the realm of the intangible and into the world of the non-material. At least you can no longer perceive the objects of study of the science of that period and of the present period with the ordinary senses. The senses have to be greatly extended. One thinks about now, 80 years later, of the search for the God particle. Particle physics certainly has taken us into the realm of the intangible and into the world of the non-material, where matter and energy are understood as equivalent. This is a tremendous releasing formula, that matter is energy, energy is matter. It opens the door to magic and the possibility of precipitation from subtler realms into dense, and of dematerialization from dense realms into subtle. So we see that DK's indications are correct, even though, let us say, from 1950 to the year 2000, the emphasis upon the fifth ray ashram was lessened for the sake of humanity, lest its knowledge of these things run too far ahead of its social and moral development. Hence also the fact that the opposition to occultism is waning. I guess Mars and the Martian religions would put up a very great opposition to occultism because it challenges the familiar world. We see many vestigial sixth-ray types living in a type of consciousness which can only be described as material, and even when it's spiritual, it's materially spiritual. Spiritual materialism. So the heaven as conceived, the other world as conceived, is still very material. But anyway, that is not the occult perspective, nor is it the mystical perspective. And the opposition to occultism is waning. It's a Martian opposition. And its day of power is approaching. HPB tell us by the end of the 21st century? She put it in terms which are more difficult to understand, but I believe that what we call occultism must win the day by the end of the 21st century. That gives us another 90 years of work, and with the speed with which things are occurring, revelations are occurring, it doesn't seem impossible at all. These subtler senses will supersede the physical senses over which Mars has so long had a successful control. How very interesting. Its association with the lower fifth ray. Just the way, in a sense, we can say that Venus is associated with the higher fifth ray. And also Uranus is there as well, and Mercury as well. They all have, I think, fifth ray components. So these subtler senses will supersede the physical senses. Already with Kirlian photography we see this, and with the study of auras we see this. In the field of medicine, that's another frontier where subtle energy is emerging as a reality. Medicine and physics, these seem to be the two areas where pioneering research is occurring, although it's much more accepted generally in the area of nuclear physics, but increasingly enlightened physicians are understanding the energy treatment. These subtler senses will supersede the physical senses over which Mars has so long had a successful control. It's something like the transition from Newtonian physics to Einsteinian physics. It's as if the type of physics which Newton brought to such a pinnacle of understanding is more Martian in nature. But the physics of the late 19th, early 20th, and now 21st century sees the waning of the Martian influence. And hence again, the growth in the world today of the psychic senses. This is under Neptune, isn't it? And the appearance on every hand of the subtler and more esoteric powers of clairvoyance and clairaudience. So here and there, there have been, here and there, accurate psychics. I guess Jeffrey Hodson is a good example of a level-headed, intelligent, respectable psychic, and I'm sure there are many more working in psychic research under the fifth and seventh rays. But I think using the general sensitivity of Neptune, and in a way, Mars can be considered a kind of polar opposite of Neptune. Neptune, the planet of subtlety, of water, of life. And Mars, the planet of objectivity, of blood, and of matter and lower energy. Yeah. So I would not at all be surprised to see scientists involved in psychic research having a strong Neptune in their chart. And of course, if they wish to correlate what is found with the conventional revelation of the senses, perhaps Mars is strong as well, and Saturn is very important. The blend of subtlety, Neptune, and the concrete nature, Saturn, Mars, is important for the corroboration of that which the subtle senses reveals. So this development is inevitable, as the influence of Scorpio and of Mars begins to lessen, as is the case today. Now, here is a statement which makes me think that some of what was written here has been interpolated from later writings. It doesn't say the year 1945 will see this influence almost completely vanish, but it seems to suggest that the writing has occurred after 1945. So I'm not sure how this was all put together, but the year 1945 saw this, I suppose, cruder Martian influence, this influence almost completely vanish, particularly from the astral plane. I suppose people had no more desire to fight after 1945, in an era which was intended to see the building of the peace through the United Nations did supervene. So sometimes when we're looking at these books, even though we know when certain parts of them were written, other parts may have been interpolated from later periods. The book came out in terms of lessons, and maybe when these lessons were assembled and later published as books, a mixture was present. I suspect that esoteric astrology was not published as a book until the 1950s. Anyway, when DK then could be speaking of the period 1950 in which we would see the waning of the Martian influence, he said it would be within the next 5 years or so. it would wane. And if he's writing around the year 1945, then it's understandable that he's talking about a time ahead. So a materiality lessening as Mars nears the end of its present cycle of influence. Okay. So the year 1945 saw this influence almost entirely vanish, particularly from the astral plane. There's still, you know, many, many wars are going on, and sometimes astonishing to realize how many wars, smaller wars, have occurred during the 20th century. Indeed, a warring century. We sometimes think only in terms of the major wars, but many lesser wars have been occurring. So anyway, the ruling of the astral plane by Mars is very important, because where there is the desire for fighting, it's far more serious than the working out upon the physical plane of occasional skirmishes. When the desire wanes, fighting upon the physical plane will also wane. But again, we almost see, strangely, as Mars approached its closest position to the Earth in many years, it's the closest in 70,000 years just recently, a couple, 3 years ago, was it? There's again been the rising of the desire to fight, the kind of Armageddon consciousness, and the desires associated with that. Some 6th-ray types seeking to bring this on because it promises the end of a limited world and the onset of a paradisical world, a heavenly world, and others because it promises the domination of their ideology over other ideologies. So again, the desire to fight has been rising. This is some 60 years later. So let us see when the Tibetan again writes how he describes this particular period in relation to the planet Mars. Astrologers would do well to remember that the influence of the constellation, signs, and planets works out upon three levels of awareness. This is one of those important hints. Three descending levels, and are felt first of all upon the mental plane, then upon the astral plane, and finally upon the physical plane. Well, I think there are certain descending influences which will continue to work out on the physical plane, even though a keen desire for their working out is no longer sustaining them. But where the astral plane, at least in some, is becoming re-energized for a great battle, then we can only hope that the fading out of the 6th-ray cycle somehow neutralizes the possibility of this desire for battle precipitating upon the physical plane. There are so many intricate cycles. DK speaks of cycles of which we can have no knowledge. And he gives their starting points as years, which we might never think of as starting points. So there are greater and lesser cycles, and about them we know very little, but we must know more. And when all knowledge is achieved on the third level of the atmic plane, presumably by a master, then this type of knowledge of cycles will be ours. Right now we have to piece this knowledge together as best we can. Some have done a good job with this, taking the hints that are given and discerning some cyclic truth. I think Stephen Pugh has done a good job with this, piecing together the probable ray cycles, but there's still much more, with cycles and sub-cycles and sub-sub-cycles and so forth, which are indeed relevant. Okay, but it is with this last plane, namely the physical plane, that the astrologers are primarily concerned. He's speaking of very exoteric astrologers. They're working, excuse me, very much in the realm of effects. So, they are emphasizing happenings and events, and not their conditioning causes. Well, that's one of the ways in which esoteric astrology will decrease our ignorance in this area. It will emphasize conditioning causes which inevitably work out, and then attention will be placed upon dealing with the causes and not simply with the effects. And in that way, we shall become much more effective in changing and transforming those conditions which must be changed and transformed. At present, DK says, astrology deals with effects and not with that which is causing them. But I think those of us who have studied esoteric astrology, we do realize that we are shifting our understanding into the world of causes. There is much confusion over this matter, and the horoscopes of the three levels are often much distorted. You know, this must have been very new information at the time it was given. A horoscope which could be interpreted purely upon the mental plane is given a physical interpretation, and thus happenings which are entirely mental are portrayed as physical occurrences. You kind of wonder how these horoscopes can be set up. Do we leave the horoscope as it is? Do we put a particular planet which rules a particular plane on the ascendant of the horoscope and thus create a house configuration which more truly represents activity upon the particular plane associated with that planet? There's much experimentation which can be done. But of course, the realm of imagination, of fancy, enters, so we have to make sure that our multiple speculations are actually correlated with facts and not arbitrarily imposed upon facts, skewing the interpretation, the correct interpretation of those facts. So thus, happenings which are entirely mental are portrayed as physical occurrences, and when we're interpreting horoscopes, we have to speak of changes in mind, changes in the emotional nature, finally, changes in the realm of physical plane effects. A clue to this triple interpretation, which astrology must eventually recognize, can be found in the relation of the orthodox, the esoteric, and hierarchical planets, and the rays of which they are the expression. I do know that some astrologers have taken this sentence and have made a correlation of orthodox planets with the realm of physical events, of esoteric planets with emotional changes, and with of hierarchical planets and rulers with changes upon the mental plane. We can see the extent to which this actually does work out. Of course, you know, in general, esoteric rulers are employed when a degree of soul expression is coming into the life, and hierarchical rulers are employed when the expression of the spirit, the monad, is becoming somewhat real. Of course, the monad reflects itself in the mind. Monadic ray reflects itself in the mind, the soul ray reflects itself in the astral body, and the personality ray reflects itself in the physical body. So you can see this lesser subset of mind, emotions, and body as correlated with monad, soul, and personality. So there's probably a theoretical justification for doing as these often quite accomplished astrologers do. The question is, how much of the content of mind, emotions, and body are actually revealed by applying these three sets of rulerships as presently applied. This is something which has to be laboriously established and not just remain a matter of theoretical interest. Okay, continuing here, there may have been a little technical hiatus. So we have this method of looking at the three levels of planets related to the three lower vehicles, as each one of these vehicles represents one of the periodical vehicles. The physical body represents the personality as a periodical vehicle, the astral body represents the soul, causal body as a periodical vehicle, and then the mind represents the monad as a periodical vehicle. So DK is impressing upon us the importance of Scorpio and Mars. Not necessarily the most pleasant energies in the Libran sense of pleasantness, of harmony and beauty in the normal sense. He says, you will see from this how important are the functions of Scorpio and Mars upon our planet at this time, and you will note also how brief a time remains in which humanity can, rightly or wrongly, handle its tests. Now, you know, when was this written? If it was written in 1945, then DK may be looking toward the future, which includes even our present era, saying that we are within that brief time wherein these tests must be handled. If it was written earlier, say in the 30s, then the question of the impending Second World War could have been considered. He says, you will realize also the pressure under which the hierarchy at this time struggles, now that Martian energy is expressing itself upon the astral plane. Well, see, doesn't it almost look as if this section was written before the preceding section, which said the period of 1945 saw the highest expression of Mars, especially upon the astral plane? Let's see if we can. The year 1945 saw this influence almost completely vanish. And then down here, where we're reading, we see that in fact, he's telling us something about now that the Martian energy is expressing itself upon the astral plane. So there's quite a difference between Martian energy almost completely vanishing in 1945 and the idea of Mars expressing itself strongly upon the astral plane, which suggests to me that the section we're now reading was written earlier than the section which preceded it. So humanity really had to handle its tests during the Second World War, if this was written in the 30s. And humanity could have gone down, and almost did, as we have been told, in the before the sun moved northward in 1942, when the hierarchy was packing its bags, so to speak, preparing to withdraw, believing that humanity would go down to defeat. But if this was written in the 30s, then apparently we have passed some tests and did not go down. At least then we did not go down. Hierarchy certainly struggles under pressures, even though their sense of time is completely different than our own, and even though they realize in a way the illusory nature of time as commonly understood, they do have time pressures and speak now of how brief a time remains. This is a master speaking, and he's speaking of time as we usually conceive it. Time as an aspect of the world of illusion with which we have to deal. Did humanity rightly handle its test? Did it sweep the devils out of the home? Later, perhaps, to find that more entered? Okay, but did it at least succeed excuse me, in the second phase of the war to clean house? Anyway, hierarchy was extremely mobilized during the period of the Second World War, and even in the Tibetan's communications with his students through Alice Bailey, we see the degree of his involvement, the degree of his preoccupation. At one point, 2 years passed between his communications to the group that he was cultivating. He must have been very busy indeed with the most pressing matters designed to help humanity succeed and not go down. Will the world Hercules lift this problem up into heaven and elevate the hydra of passion and hate, of greed and aggression, and of selfishness and ambition up into the region of the soul? Will these lower tendencies be seen? Will they be neutralized by that neutral form of electricity, solar fire? Will they be overcome, lifted up into the region of the soul? Or will humanity, the disciple, the world Hercules, carry the whole matter down onto the physical plane with the inevitable corollary of world disaster, world war, and death? Well, indeed, there was world disaster, world war, and death. In other words, it seems here that he's writing in such a sense that he's questioning whether there will be a second phase of the Great War, which ended with an armistice in 1918. Would there be a second phase? Because they struggled mightily to prevent that second phase. And humanity, the world Hercules, did carry the whole matter down. And there was world disaster. There certainly was world war. We call it World War II. There was a huge reaping, the culling of human beings through the processes of death, millions and millions. Such are the problems with which the guiding hierarchy is faced, and they are faced with it in the time sense. Now, if, for instance, this was written at the same time as a writing which could say when 1945 came, this occurred, so then in the 40s, then DK could be speaking of our present time and wondering whether we would succeed in avoiding world war disaster and death. And these things still face us, although he did say that the Shambhala impact of the year 2000 could be succeeded by perhaps less destruction than previous Shambhala impacts. So there's a little ambiguity here. But certainly we can interpret it in both ways, and I think it makes a lot of sense to interpret this in terms of the possibly impending Second World War, which the hierarchy sought to avert through the good offices of the disciples of the world, who were not powerful enough or perhaps numerous enough to avert world war. The question is still one which comes before us, especially in a nuclear age. I believe that hierarchy had so much rearranging of its plans due to the release of atomic energy through the atomic bomb. So much rearranging of its hitherto created plans, because the possibility of humanity truly annihilating itself quite permanently then loomed as a possibility. And DK did say it was a possibility which could be visioned, not some idle dream. So later DK will talk about the plans as they did exist for the reappearance of the Christ, I think, in the 20th century, and the plans as they had to be modified, I think, due to the very real appearance of atomic energy through atomic weaponry at the end of the Second World War. So hierarchy is faced with a great time problem and is trying to prevent, even now, humanity from going down in a still greater world disaster and greater world war and far more universal death than occurred even in the Second World War, which he said, I think, would be considered something like child's play compared to the war which could emerge. Scorpio is also most interestingly connected with the constellation Cancer through the influence of the sixth ray, coming via Neptune, correct? So there is the esoteric ruler Neptune and the hierarchical ruler Neptune conveying the sixth ray. Cancer itself, as a constellation, does not, related to the sixth ray of Mars. For it should be remembered that that ray is also expressing itself through Neptune, but in a spiritual and esoteric manner, related not to the blood, but to the life, as he is fond of saying. So, you know, the spiritualization of science is also related to Neptune and all of the psychic research which is underway. Neptune governs Cancer esoterically and also hierarchically. The significance is therefore clear, for Cancer is the sign of birth. It is the door into incarnation and the sign of generation. The processes of creating the physical vehicle are undertaken in Cancer, the incarnation, the sacrocentric processes leading to incarnation. So the moon is connected with that sacrocenter from some perspective, and the moon is also the ruler of Cancer. The desire for incarnation has created this descent into incarnation. Scorpio is the sign of sex and regeneration. Well, it's one of the signs of sex, Taurus being another, Libra being another. Scorpio is the sign of sex, which leads to physical incarnation in Cancer. I don't know how we would count that. Scorpio, Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius, Pisces, and then Aries, Taurus, Gemini. Well, if we count forward, we get 9 signs, and then the 10th sign being one of birth. So Scorpio is the sign of sex and of regeneration. So into matter and out of matter, regeneration, meaning that we generate ourselves and do not generate our own kind. My old teacher used to say that there comes a time in the life of every disciple when he ceases reproducing his own kind and then reproduces himself, which is interesting. The factor of regeneration has to do with the building the new man in Christ, building the man who becomes the soul rather than the man who descends into incarnation. So true regeneration is, or the result of regeneration is occurring at the fourth initiation. But many things lead to that, a constant improvement on the generating of the self in its true nature. Scorpio is the sign of sex and of regeneration, both together, and birth in Cancer is ever the intended result of the sex relation. So DK seems to be making a comment about our present attitudes towards sexuality as something psychological, as something to promote perhaps better physical health, something that is simply an indulgence of the instinctual nature without thought of the intended result, which is ever intended. He seems to be a conservative in this respect, and I think we do have much to learn from his ideas here. The Dalai Lama pretty much said the same. So right now these sexual forces are being prostituted in many ways to the glorification of the lower ego. It's difficult to extricate oneself from those tendencies, but a greater perspective makes that possible. Ever the intended result of the sexual, of the sex relation. So sex leads to birth. A Scorpio leads to Cancer. Father, Spirit, and Mother Matter, when brought together, produce the Son. And this is an extrapolation of the sexual relation toward a more cosmic perspective. The tests and difficulties and pains of this era are symptoms or indications of the entering into manifestation of the new civilization and culture. So Scorpio, by helping us to confront this pain which occurs when the soul descends into matter and attempts to establish its fifth kingdom within the realm of the fourth kingdom of nature. Scorpio assists with this descent, and the pains and difficulties are worth bearing. They are birthing pains, in essence. So these pains and difficulties, they portend, says DK, the birth of the new era, for which the entire world waits, and much of the waiting is actually unconscious waiting. This will happen if, and DK does open the possibility here of delay, if, speaking esoterically, the sixth ray energy of Mars is transmuted into the sixth ray energy of Neptune. For the one is objective and full of blood, and the other is subjective and full of life. That's the quotation, which defines very clearly the relationship between Mars and Neptune. We do need the Christ, who is Vishnu, who is Neptune, who represents the great subjective life, and who is the initiator of humanity for the first two initiations. Neptune is involved in that initiation process, producing essentially the mystic rather than the occultist. We need this very much. And the transmutative process is up to us. So I will end Esoteric Astrology Adventures 78B at this point, and we will see whether there will be a 78C or whether we will go on to 79. Let us together sound the great invocation. And it's good to see it for those who may not know it by heart. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Okay, friends, we will move on with our discussion shortly. Continuing in the Scorpio chapter. We'll see you then.